Hello, my name is Dave Lewis, and I am the host of Cinemillennials, a podcast where myself and another millennial watch a classic film for the very first time, ranging from the 1890s to 1969, and discuss its significance and relevance in our world today. On today's episode of Cinemillennials, I talked with Harry Marks, writer for Cabinet of Curiosities and host of Let's All Go to the Lobby on TikTok, about 1958's A Night to Remember, hailed by many as the most accurate depiction of the tragic sinking of the Titanic on the silver screen. While not the most well-known film in the United States, A Night to Remember has left an indelible mark on not only audience members, but generations of directors and the disaster genre as a whole. A Night to Remember follows the story of the sinking of the Titanic, from its hopeful beginning to its terrible end, from its lower-class passengers trying to make a new life for themselves, to its stiff upper lip of the upper echelon. So sit back, try to relax, and most importantly, look out for icebergs! Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show. What was the first film you saw in theaters, and what are your favorite films at the moment?
Thank you for having me. So the first film, I don't remember the first film I actually saw in theaters, but I do remember going to the movie theater to see Beauty and the Beast in 1992, the Disney cartoon. And then my favorites right now, my favorites always change. It's like asking someone their favorite food. I mean, it really is whatever I last ate. But lately, the more modern favorites right now are The Holdovers from last year, Evil Dead Rise, I thought was excellent. And then classics, I mean, my favorites tend to stay pretty much the same. And they're usually the chestnuts like Casablanca, Citizen Kane, anything Humphrey Bogart, really, Maltese Falcon, In a Lonely Place. And then also Sweet Smell of Success is probably my favorite film of all time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our episode on Kane Mutiny that we just recently did. That was a film that I knew almost nothing about and is very much in theme with the film that we're going to talk about today. In the intro, I talked about your TikTok channel. Can you explain Let's All Go to the Lobby and where you get your inspiration from?
Let's All Go to the Lobby is my TikTok and Instagram, but I'm primarily active on TikTok. And it's dedicated to classic film, film history, Hollywood history. There are a lot of little mini documentaries I do about like drive-in movie theaters or Turner Classic Movies, the channel itself, William Castle gimmicks from the 1950s and stuff. And then the main thing I do are introductions to classic films like you would find on Turner Classic Movies. So they're about 3.5 minutes apiece. They're full of facts and information about the making of the films, and they're delivered in a style akin to what you might see Ben Mankiewicz or, in the past, Robert Osborne, what they would have done before Turner Classic Movies would air a film.
I found TikTok pretty early on within my own kind of TikTok sphere, because when you do something like this, you have to try to find other people that do this. How did you grow up within classic films? Was it something that was always on TV for you? Was it something that just happened to you? Or was this kind of like a familial thing that you grew up with?
My love of classic film was sort of bred in me at a young age. TCM was always on in the house, or a VHS, The Harvey Girls, or you know, any classic films were on TV, either my mom watching in the bedroom or my dad watching in the den. And so I grew up just surrounded by classic film and classic film history. There was rarely a moment when I wasn't listening to Judy Garland or Humphrey Bogart or Tony Curtis or whoever was on at the time. And by that measure, also Robert Osborne was like a constant figure I can remember in the house. And that's really where the inspiration for my channel came from, was my love of TCM and specifically my love of those introductions. I almost love them more than the films themselves, because I've always loved the history and the making of stuff. That's always my favorite thing on the DVD, is the either the commentary or the behind the scenes footage. So I had started my TikTok account over a year ago, and I was sort of floundering, and I'd post a couple videos here and there, and I was trying to figure out like what I wanted this channel to be, because I didn't know what direction I wanted to take. And I had sort of stumbled upon Film Talk a little bit, and I was looking, and everyone's talking about the same modern hits or you know, new releases, and I was like, there's got to be something different here. And I started finding classic film talkers, and that was the niche I wanted to be in. And I realized the one thing that was missing from TikTok and seemed to fit the bill best for that platform because it's all short form video, were the introductions. And that really came from, I found Turner Classic Movies' channel on TikTok, and they posted clips from the movies, but I was always shocked that they never posted the intros. That's the best part of the channel, is the introduction to the movie. So I figured I would fill that void, and I would research and write and host my own introductions to these classic films.
Yeah, there's so many great niche communities on TikTok. I particularly work with Tolkien Talk because I do have a love for everything J.R.R. Tolkien. And you know, when I found yours, I was like, this is great because then I can get my classic fix as well. And there's like other people like Baraka and a couple other people that really Be Kind Rewind and,
Hey, a lot of another one. Too.
Hey, Marianne. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of great people on there. And I think that that is an amazing thing because it's such a modern platform for something that is so quote unquote old, and how the majority of younger people that are using that app are not susceptible to watching that. But at the same time, there are a lot of people that also do thirst traps for different old Hollywood actors and actresses. So there is there a big kind of, or not thirst traps, but like kind of like thirsting off of old clips and compilations and things like that, which I think is fun. Yeah, but I think there's,
I also love Jimmy Stewart, you know,
in an inappropriate exactly. way.
So let's go.
Yeah, don't get me started on James Stewart, James Maitland Stewart. But no, he's one of my all-time favorites, and I'm so upset that no one has picked It's a Wonderful Life yet, but that's another topic for another day. But
I've seen it every year for the last 10 years. So
we've had this conversation before. We have very, very close ties to the film, and it's just a shame that no one else wants to watch that movie. So whoever wants to come on and watch it, please come on. Please email me. But anyway, why do you think that there is this kind of resurgence into watching classic films, and why do you think millennials should watch classic film?
So the resurgence of classic film, I think film talk as a community, even if they don't realize it, are learning about classic film from the modern films they watch. And I did a video recently and within the last several weeks about how last year's popular movies like Barbie and The Holdovers owe their success and owe their existence to classic films like Singing in the Rain or The Ladies Man or the Harold and Maude. And so there's a history there that I, even if they don't realize it because they're not actively watching these films, they're getting pieces of it in watching the Ken ballet from Barbie, or just watching The Holdovers, or the tracking shots in Saltburn, and the nod to Kubrick and The Shining. And I think getting that even subconsciously opens up something in them to explore that further. And so they go and watch these films and they realize, oh, this is where everything comes from. This is where that history begins. And I would love to know, there are certain people in the classic film talk community like Lila and Hey Marianne, and either my age or like way younger, 18, 19, 20. Mm-hmm. I'm late 30s. I'm turning 40 in a couple of years. So anyone younger than like 25 is way younger. But mm-hmm. they're all about Basil Rathbone or Jimmy Stewart, or like, where did that come from? Like, what is that about? Like, Lila, I know, is a huge Conrad Veidt fan. Like, where did that love of Conrad?
Me too.
And he's fantastic. But like, you don't hear a lot of Gen Zers or Gen Alphas or whoever like talk about Conrad Veidt. It's just, it's not something that comes up. I'd love to know from them, like, what was it that drew you to them?
Absolutely. I mean, that's another great, you know, prompt that we could do on TikTok. There's so many different ways into these movies and into these people and who they were. I think there's a lot of films recently that have, like, especially like Babylon and Mank and things like that, that have been an introduction point right. to old Hollywood for a lot of people that are coming up, especially wanting to watch and wanting to know everything about film. I think it's just a fascinating point in film right now where it's more accessible than ever. And people that make the films are open with their inspirations and open with what moved them as an audience. Now, why did you pick A Night to Remember?
So A Night to Remember is funny for me because, A, I'm a huge Titanic fan going back to when I was a kid and James Cameron's movie comes out. And I had just been fascinated by the ship and the wreck and just how that all happened. And then I had done an intro for this film, but I had never actually seen it. I had done the research on the film and did the intro for it, but I had never actually seen A Night to Remember. It was one of my first Criterion buys in the last sale that they had. You sent me the list of films, and I was like, oh, A Night to Remember, I just got that one. Let me go watch that. And I wanted to see how they portrayed, because I knew about the end of the film and how the ship goes down in one piece, and we know better now because of Robert Ballard in the 80s and everything. But I had wanted to see their portrayal of the events of that night to remember, you know, compared to what we saw in James Cameron's film, which I think is the, even though there have been other films about the Titanic and the sinking and everything, I feel like you've got A Night to Remember and you've got 1997's Titanic starring Leonardo DiCaprio as like the two definitive tellings of that tale.
The thing that I always heard about A Night to Remember is through the same thing, is through Criterion. I knew it was a British film. I knew that it was about the Titanic. I didn't know anything else about that because it was my first time watching this as well. I watched it on Criterion Channel. I've been wanting to see it for a long time because you hear about how great it is and how influential it is for later films. And I didn't know too much about the Titanic. It's just, you know, the thing that you learn in school and know more about the 1900s, especially in Edwardian England at the time and things like that. It is a titan amongst, excuse the pun, things within that period. It is one of the most pivotal moments of the early 1900s. And I always heard that this film is the most accurate portrayal of the Titanic because of who was on the set on the day and who wrote the original book, A Night to Remember. What did you think of the film overall? And can you compare it to James Cameron's Titanic?
Absolutely. I love the film, especially the Criterion cut, whatever they did. I mean, it was incredible. I love that this was a story about the people and not so much the ship itself, even though the ship is a big part of telling the story. I feel like when you compare it to Cameron's was all about, hey, we've got special effects and we've got a nearly life-size replica of the ship and we've got all this. And it was almost like you're watching a movie about the ship and not so much the people on board. And this was so much different than that. And I know that that's partly because of the source material, which took a lot of survivor stories to create. And then also, I think because of the limitation of special effects, you had to focus on the people more in order to tell that story. You couldn't tell the story about the ship sinking and expect to get any kind of spectacle the way you would get with James Cameron's version.
I absolutely agree. I love this film. I was totally filled with anxiety the whole time. I think the strongest point about this film is the performances. And I believe truly that they, like, if I knew these actors, how they have Kate Winslet and DiCaprio and Billy Zane and all these people that, like, you know, we grew up watching, it takes away from a lot of that kind of thing. What did you think of the performances? Were they believable as people going through this tragedy or actors performing?
They were, and I point to how the rich behaved as the ship was sinking. You had, first there was the incredulity at the possibility of the ship sinking. I think that's something we lost in Cameron's version. Was one thing I kept hearing during this film was, but it's unsinkable. Like the marketing of this ship and the hubris behind the ship, everyone believed it was impossible for the ship to sink. And I think that lent to the wealthy characters like Strauss and Guggenheim. There's that scene with Guggenheim in his stateroom trying on the life vest and then putting the cape over it. And he's basically taking his time. He's like, I'll get there when I get there, as he's trying to be like pushed out to the deck to get into a boat or something. And it's like, this is what these people care about. It's like looking good, or the women crowding around the guy monitoring the safe and being like, I want my jewels. I'm not leaving without them. That's what they cared about. They didn't care about their lives or anything. It was all their stuff that they had brought with them. And then there was that one woman and her husband who were, I don't believe this is sinking. This is all temporary. And then as they start to see that people are getting into the lifeboat, she's saying to her husband, like, why aren't they allowing you into the boat with me? And, you know, I heard that on the other side of the boat, they're letting men in with the women and children. And so they sneak off and they get into the boat. And it was just like, that's exactly how I pictured these wealthy people to behave. And so I think that lent to the authenticity of the performances. And from what I understand, they had survivors on set to help with these performances. And I think that rings true here.
Yeah, so they absolutely had a few survivors. And they had one of the account is basically based off this man named Lightoller. He was the fourth officer on the Titanic, and he was, I want to believe that he was on set, as well as a few other people and survivors. I think one of the best things about when you're finding an introduction to classic film, but not only classic film, but when you're getting into other countries' classic films, mm-hmm. you know, specifically this is a British production, you don't know who these people are. So right. they are fully believable as these people. It's not a performance, especially in this film. It's more of a docudrama that works really well and is not clunky because it is able to follow every single person in first class, second class, third class. It follows everybody. It doesn't just follow the rich people or doesn't just follow, you know, a couple or something like right. that. The director is able to juggle so many different social stratas and their mindsets in so many different ways at the same time. So consistently as well.
We're introduced to a lot of these characters in the beginning of the film. There's the Lord and Lady leaving the giant castle and the kids waving to them as they head towards the ship. And there's the newlyweds and then there's the third class passengers. And so we sort of follow them throughout the film. And this, you know, one of my complaints about the film was we sort of rush to get to the night. It's like suddenly right. it's April 10th and then suddenly it's April 14th. And it was like, where did that time go? But in that, once we get to the actual hitting of the iceberg, we then sort of bounce from head to head and we get to see how they handle this adversity thrown at them as they try to survive this ship sinking. And we really learn about them as they go. And I really love just getting to know the different classes and how the different classes interact with each other. It was so well done. And it's something I think was, again, severely lacking in Cameron's version, which is really just about Kate and Leo and their romance and stuff. And we see pieces of these other people like Strauss or Ismay or Andrews, but like they are part of the story here. And I think it makes it a much more thoughtful telling of the sinking of the Titanic.
Absolutely. I think it was, for the most part, compassionate towards the people that were on the ship.
Yeah.
And with this film and its importance and how it is this first of many now series of disaster films, in that it is so far away from the disaster films of today and how it's all about the gore, it's all about the violence, it's all about the building of anxiety. This film builds anxiety because it is the truth in that situation. Although they do not have that panic, when most survivors talk about it, they do not remember panic. They remember it being oddly calm and right. not frantic all over the place. Like most, you know, Final Destination, the Poseidon Adventure, things like that, having this great panic. It was an utter shock to these people that this is happening. And I think a lot of problems with historical films is that they reflect on the past because of where they are now. I feel like this film doesn't do that. I feel like this film, yes, they have the eyewitness stories and testimony and that is being put in. But when you're watching the film, you're not seeing the characters react as they would react today. They're reacting within that moment. How do you think it reflects upon the sinking? Does the historical hindsight aid with the storytelling or does it hinder it?
I feel like the filmmakers wanted us to feel like we were on the boat with them. And I know when this film was made, the Titanic was not the legendary ship that we all know of it today. When this book came out, the Titanic wasn't discussed even in like common conversation the way we talk about it now. So I don't think a lot of people knew the intricacies of what had happened that night. Things are different now. And so I feel like when we either make films or we talk about it, we imagine, well, if I was on that ship, I'd be freaking out. I'd be running up and down the decks. But to see essentially these survivor stories played out on screen and to hear words like, well, she's unsinkable. There's that scene where the captain is in Andrews's room and Andrews tells him the ship will sink in an hour and a half. And Smith is like, but she's unsinkable. And it's like, you don't get it. But they were so sold on the idea that this ship, you know, as Billy Zane says, God himself could not sink this ship. you know, they were so sold on the idea that this ship could not go down. I think that's where that lack of panic came from. There was that one scene where the girl gets in the lifeboat and her friend or sister or whoever was like, remember, you can't get back on board if you don't have your pass. Like, they thought this is a temporary thing. They were going to get in their lifeboats. They were going to sort of float there for a little bit. The captain was going to fix whatever he had to fix. And then they were going to get back on the ship and go to New York. I think a lot of people thought there's no way the ship is sinking. This is all just one, either a big misunderstanding or this is being blown out of proportion. And so that lack of panic on their side, we know what's going on because we can see the water lapping up the hallways. We can see there's that one scene of the food cart in the first class dining room that just sort of like drifts a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then it moves on to the next scene. And that was so powerful because that's like, oh no, the ship is sinking. Like it dipped a little more. There are all these little ways that they showed the ship sinking without showing the ship sinking that were instilling panic in me as I'm watching. And I know how it all ends, but I think those directorial decisions to show that the panic isn't on the people there. They think this is all just going to blow over. The panic is for us. Mm-hmm. I think that lent to the authenticity of the film. And I think it also made it a more anxiety ridden film as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that was for me, like I was, you know, I watch a film and of course my fiance and her parents and I are all going on a cruise next week. So I was like, oh, this is a great time to watch this. Great. But like, I honestly thought it was a docudrama where it was going to go into every little detail and was going to do that, but it doesn't. But at the same time, it does, because like you were mentioning Guggenheim and Strauss and things like that. And they have the unsinkable Molly Brown in that as well. Yeah. You have these characters that are mentioned, but not going into depth with. Like, it's not like a Ken Burns documentary or anything like that. It's genuinely what the history is for the most part. There's, you know, obviously little redundancies and things like that based on, and obviously models that they used for special effects. But I think the whole brilliance of the film is that it does see people as people for who they are and who they were. And that kind of idea, they have the identity of who these people were, like, you know, a stiff upper lip kind of situation of the time period,
right.
the hubris of it all, the confidence of it all, you know, the empire of it all, essentially, from the British perspective. And we know it's going to happen. We know. But right. Unless you're well into Titanic history, you don't know when it's exactly happening as an audience member. You don't know when it's going to happen unless you have that experience about the Titanic, knowing what time and what day. I didn't know what time when it happened. Whereas I feel like films today just hit you over the head with what's going on immediately.
Exactly. I think it's impossible to talk about this film without talking about Cameron's. And Cameron's was all about the spectacle of the ship with its stern in the air, and then it cracks in half and people tumbling off the propellers and all. Like, you get a sense of the devastation in his film more than you do in this film. Mm-hmm. But you also see people crushed under smoke funnels in A Night to Remember. You see people drowning. One thing I loved that they included in here, and you see him for a split second in Cameron's version, like, or as the ship is going down, but they put Charles Jochen in this movie. And he's like an actual character in here. Do you know the story of Charles Jochen?
No, I don't. Please tell me.
Charles Jochen was the baker on the Titanic.
Yes.
He had 13 people, a baker's dozen, under him. And so as the ship is sinking, he's getting schlitzed in his stateroom. He's drinking himself to, you would think, to sleep, but he's like three sheets to the wind. There's that scene where it's like there are a bunch of guys in the hallway and they're asking, you know, where do we go? And he's like, you know, go forth and do whatever. And he doesn't care about anything. And so, you know, he goes down, not with the ship, but he goes down. I think he's kicked off the ship in reality. He was like pushed by a lifeboat or something into the water. Mm-hmm. And so in real life, Charles Jochen treads water for 2.5 hours until he's picked up by a lifeboat and then eventually by the Carpathia. This is the same water that froze people to death because it was so cold, even though it was April 14th, 15th. You know, the reason he survived is because he had so much alcohol in his system, he didn't feel the cold, and all he suffered were swollen feet by the time they saved him. It was unbelievable. And just the fact that they made him a character in this film, that they included him in the story, I love that to pieces.
It's actually funny that you say that, because I do know the story of that now that you're reminding me of it, because Criterion Channel, and I'm sure the DVD or Blu-ray has it, is that they have a commentary by two people from the Titanic Historical Society that do a commentary, and they talked about him, but they did say that he had no injuries, but it's also maybe not because of the alcohol in his system, because apparently alcohol, if you have alcohol in your system, it brings your temperature, your inner temperature down instead of up. Okay. Which is like a popular misnomer, but like it's I didn't know that until I watched the commentary. And I think, you know, you were talking about commentaries before. I think that's a great idea to have, like, historical people or people that know the historical event that the film is centered around to discuss it. And I think that was really eye opening when they were talking about that. And, you know, the accuracy, when you're talking about the accuracy of James Cameron's Titanic versus this one is known by so many different people that this is the most accurate Titanic film. These people were real. And I think the devastation, although it is not as prominent as it is in other adaptations, I think it's felt way more. My fiance and I were literally on the verge of tears while the people were on the lifeboats, just seeing it sink and seeing their faces completely drop with no lights around them. And even having the great perspective of the Carpathian, the Olympic. I think it's the Olympic, right? Yeah. With the other.
It was the, the Olympic and the Californian were the.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. The Californian. Yeah. So it was great to see their perspectives as well. And their great triumph in helping those people, even though they were late, or their downfall, which led to a lot of people criticizing them after the film came out. I feel like a lot of classic films try to stick to the historical record, and this film is such a great example of them trying to do that.
The filmmakers saw that the story here was in the survivors or in the in the stories of the people on the ship. It wasn't in the ship itself. James Cameron made a movie about the Titanic, and look at my Titanic, and look at it in the middle of the ocean, and look at all the digital people I put on the deck, and, you know, oh, look at it split in half and someone bounce off the propeller and all this. Like, that movie was about the boat and also his personal selfish desire to go see the wreckage himself,
right,
and all of that and film it. This film was about those people. And I also was getting like choked up when Isidore Strauss and his wife are arguing about her getting on the boat. And she's like, you know, she's like, well, you and I have spent so many years together. We've lived our lives together. Where you go, I go. And I'm like, oh, my God, like that's we never right. saw that in the 97 version. You know, they're there. But like we never see the interaction between these people when, you know, they're backed against a corner and they're faced with this literal life and death situation. And I thought it made it so much more powerful.
I mean, it is always interesting to see where they focus on the characters, whether they are rich or poor or, you know, workers on the ship itself. And I think it's so fascinating to see how these kind of reflections are still in our society today. Can you see any resemblances to our own social strata in our current society that you can see reflected in Night to Remember?
Well, I mean, it's hard because the gap, the income gap, the wage gap, you know, the class gap between the poorer classes in society and the wealthier classes, like there isn't a lot of intermingling there. You know, it really takes a disaster of this proportion to get everybody in the same place, because they don't occupy the same spaces.
In the same boat, if you will.
Yeah, they're not all in the same boat all the time. And also, I've never been in a situation like this. I don't know what it would be like, but it just felt like people. There were of course people who were selfish and only cared about themselves, and there were also people who were helping others and you know, trying to get them to safety and get them on a lifeboat despite their own doom awaiting them. You've got the band playing to try and keep everyone calm and upbeat as this is all going on. Like I feel like we're a more selfish society, and I don't know how in that situation would we also be as accommodating and as helpful and friendly as the people in this, you know, situation were.
I totally agree with you there. There are situations today where we don't see that kind of human connection because of who people are and what money they make. I totally agree with you there. I mean, look at, although it was a natural disaster with the COVID-19 and everything like that during the lockdown period, there's people that are the poorer people that couldn't afford healthcare, couldn't do that kind of thing, were the ones that were punished because of a disease that they couldn't control. And, you know, I think it's funny that you say, you know, the whole idea about James Cameron and how he's this ultra wealthy kind of guy and how he does these ridiculous things where he gets Rolex watches for free and all this other ridiculous stuff. You know, it's this idea of the ultra rich are creating things without restriction and the poor are unable to survive. It's right. This whole irony of him wanting to build this thing, wanting to film this film, and by going down and to see the Titanic. And when you know, look at the idea of these people trying to do dangerous things with the money that they have because of the money that they have, it's the ultimate irony with, especially when people try to go see this ship. Yep. Last year, we had the whole Titan tour sinking to see the Titanic. Yeah, remember that whole kind of thing with the knockoff PlayStation controller and third-party stuff? And it's so interesting to see how people responded to that versus the other social issues in society that we have today. I mean, you can look at the example of the Irish immigrant family that were on the ship. I feel like a lot of people don't realize or don't remember that it's not just rich people on this ship. It's people that are looking to create a new life in America.
Yes. Yeah, that was one thing I thought Cameron's version got very well was the when the panic set in that the lower classes, the lower levels were flooding and the third class passengers were trying to get up to second class, first class to the main deck. And the gates had been locked and they had been trapped in there. And it was like, this is what they think of these people, that they are expendable, that if there isn't enough room, these people can be forgotten about and go down with the ship while the wealthier can get on the boats and get out of here. I thought that was very well done. And we saw some of that in this film as well. But I just felt like the absolute panic of that character Fabrizio as he's trying to get up the steps and, you know, he's shaking the gate with everybody like, let us out, let us out. And they're just like, sorry, no, bye. That was full on display where I didn't see it as much here. There was that one scene where the guy grabs the axe and starts chopping down the gate lock so he can get out with his friends. But like there weren't like crowds of people behind him trying to get out with him. It was just like three people and they're out the door. So, you know, I chalk that up to just, you know, lack of cast and extras and
right.
digitization and all of that. But it was something I noticed watching the film.
Do you think that they're able to, because they're not reliant on the special effects, they're not reliant on having a free kind of range to work with writing wise, literature wise, do you think that they were able to capture more of the emotional resonance with an audience, with the people that are experienced the Titanic? Do you think that they are able to work around those restrictions in order to have a more emotional effect?
Oh, absolutely. One of my common refrains is that limitations make better movies. The reason Jaws is so scary is because the shark didn't work. And so Spielberg has to try and find new ways to tell the audience that the shark is there, tell the characters that the shark is there. And then when we finally see it at the very end, even though it doesn't look like a real great white shark, in fact, I think that makes it scarier, we're totally on board because we've been led to this point where we know it's in the water. And so, oh my God, there it is. Same thing here. I think the lack of special effects or the unavailability of special effects forced them to make a movie that focused more on the story itself and the characters themselves. But also, they weren't beholden to making an action movie or a thriller movie, or like they were telling a story that actually happened. They didn't have to pad it. They didn't have to, you know, I think some of the characters were either invented or sort of smoothed over a little bit or washed over. They weren't exactly as they were, but there's very little of that in this film. In fact, some of the dialogue is pulled right from the words of the people who were there. So it was just really interesting. Like, they didn't feel the need to change anything. They didn't have to. The story was there. The action was there.
Absolutely. Its strong suit is in its subtlety, not its maximality.
So much of this film is so understated. And it's fine that it is, because that's what they wanted it to be. Like, it's understated because the people on the ship, until the actual ship was, like, halfway in the water, they were understated. They didn't think anything was going to happen. And so even though we know what's about to happen, we're sort of in this weird limbo of like, will they make it out? Will they not make it out? We're trying to keep calm with them, even though we know the ship is going to go down and half these people are going to lose their lives. They didn't have to play that up for us. We do that internally ourselves.
That is one of the strongest things about this film, is that it has that built-in anxiety. It has that built-in story that everybody now knows because of the Titanic movies and different things like that, and how it's so important to different mediums of media. And there were so many things that came out to me when watching this film. Was there anything that you saw in the film that reminded you of any TV shows or movies that came after it?
Well, it's funny, when they first hit the iceberg, and the chunks sort of fly onto the deck, and the crewmen are playing soccer with the pieces of ice. I remember that in Cameron's movie. I liked that little touch that he added. I don't know if that was accurate. It probably was, I guess, that they were playing soccer with it. But I liked that they didn't realize that, you know, this was going to all happen. They just thought, oh, wow, ice, and look, like, right off the iceberg, let's play with it. I thought that was interesting. And I guess the one thing I noticed in this film that isn't in a lot of the others is that when the action happens, there is no music, but there is music throughout the rest of the film. So when everyone's happy, they're eating, they're, you know, playing poker, whatever they're doing in the dining room or in the lounge areas, you hear the band. And then as soon as the ship hits the iceberg, the music stops. And it only picks up when the band deliberately starts playing to keep everyone calm. And I love that they didn't add an external score to this film. They really let the ship's string band or string orchestra do the music for the whole thing. I love that touch of it.
Oh, I mean, that's such a great point. I didn't even think about that. And I think so many films now are so focused on sound design and how it can be so immersive. That is such a great point, because that is, you don't even notice it, really. I mean, I didn't even notice it until I watched it the second time. It's such a great point, because it is so unnerving. Like, one of the films that I think is highly underrated that kind of does the same thing is Martin Scorsese's Silence. There's very, very little noise except for natural noise in that film at all. There's maybe like one or two songs. That's really it. And that brings that whole unnerviness to the film and what's going to happen next. You don't know. It's more true to life than true to a film. And I think the majority of what, you know, you can get influences from is, I think, obviously, we're talking about James Cameron's film. I think a lot of it, he takes a lot of shots from it specifically. He takes a lot of shots from it because, you know, obviously, like we said before, if you're going to follow in the steps of a great film, use the steps that film took to make it such a great film. But I feel like, especially with the vignettes, you have a super influence on shows like Upstairs, Downstairs, and Downton Abbey. Not only because of Downton Abbey's starting conflict in that show is the Titanic itself and their cousins going down the ship, or people that they know going down the ship, but it's how they interact with each people and how you transition from upstairs to downstairs and so on and so forth. And then, like I said before, this film is super influential because it is the opening, excuse the, you know, phrase, it's the opening of the floodgates of disaster films. Although it's not a major Hollywood blockbuster like the Poseidon Adventures and other things that came after it.
Towering Inferno, Die Hard. I mean, you know, and any of those films. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you have all these things in this film that was in the 50s that people clearly was like, all right, let's look at this film and how well they did this part and how can we up the ante even further? And I think that's where you get the most influence from for this film. And I think a lot of people who aren't used to a film like this should absolutely watch it. Why do you think millennials and the younger generations should watch A Night to Remember?
So, I mean, the performance is obviously the historical accuracy. Also, to see a film that was made before we had film seasons, you know, this, the way this film was made would not be done today, because there was no concept of the Christmas season, the Christmas film season, or the summer blockbuster. That didn't exist. Films were released when they were released. In fact, a lot of studios released films in the summer to get rid of them. The summer was sort of the dead zone for movie theaters. So, you know, this film was made to tell a story, not to fill a ledger somewhere to keep a studio in the black at a certain time of year. There is a lot to compare this film to James Cameron's version. But I also think, just if you are an aspiring filmmaker, or if you just love the history of film, the study of film, there's so much here to learn from the way it was filmed, from the use of miniatures, the way they shot in Pinewood Studios, and I think they actually shot on actual boats at certain points because the soundstage wasn't big enough to hold mm-hmm. all the sets that they wanted to build. The use of pure darkness to give you this feeling of isolation, to give you the sense that they are alone on this ocean. There is no one coming to help them. There's just so much to learn here, you know, that can be applied to today's films.
Harry, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Is there anything that you'd like to plug?
I guess I'll plug my Linktree. That's where you can find links to my TikTok, my Instagram. I've got merch, mugs, t-shirts, stickers, the whole shebang. That's at linktr.ee/hcmarks.
Harry, do you also have a book coming out?
Oh, that's right. So the company I work for is called Grim and Mild. We put out the podcast Lore, Lore Legends, Cabinet of Curiosities. And so Cabinet of Curiosities is being turned into a book, which comes out in November. The link to pre-order is being published by Macmillan. The link to pre-order is also in my Linktree. You can go pre-order it from any fine book purveyors.
I hope you enjoyed this discussion I had with Harry about A Night to Remember. Please check out his work on TikTok and Instagram. You can find him at Let's Go to the Lobby. And please pre-order his book. If you want to check out more of my work and want to watch the film we discussed, you can find me at cinemillennials.com and my YouTube channel. Thank you.